Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today my guest is Amy Bender. Her book, The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake, is published by Doubleday. It's narrator Rose Edelstein's 9th birthday, and she tastes the cake her mother has baked, her favorite, a lemon layer cake with chocolate frosting, and it just tastes, well, sad, terribly sad. Rose can barely swallow it. She knows from the taste that her mother is miserable. She tries to explain that she suddenly finds herself able to taste emotions in the food she eats. Sorrow, joy, anger, misery. She tries to tell others. They take her for tasting expeditions to bakeries, and they discover that, yes, she can, in fact, in a particular bakery on Beverly Boulevard, she says the person who made this was in a terrible hurry. And what does the counterman say?
The one who's there, she tastes that his cookie is angry. But he says, and I guess this is a crucial piece for me, is that he says, oh, no, I wasn't in any mood at all when I made this. But then he swears, and he's clearly angry, but he doesn't cop to it. So there's something about the feelings of the cook, but also the feelings that the cook might not quite know are there.
And the woman who made the other pastry always arrives late.
Yes.
So she's always in a hurry.
Exactly.
And what this poor girl does, because she barely wants to eat, everything tastes so awful, is, and of course, the school nurse, everyone else thinks it's anorexia and all of the usual teenage problems. It's not. Mm-hmm. It's a special skill. She doesn't know how to use it yet.
Right.
And what she knows from having this skill is that most of the people around her don't know what they're feeling.
Exactly.
For her, as she goes through, she stops liking food that was made by human hands. Mm-hmm. What does she come to like?
I think as a kind of respite from the overwhelm of all the information she's getting in the meals from various people, she turns to processed food that's been made by machines, because all of that food tastes blank to her, essentially. So a Dorito is just going to be a plain Dorito, and that is a huge relief, because every meal is just this kind of avalanche of emotion. And that there's that extra piece, which is that it's not only an avalanche of emotion, but that if she checks it out with the chef, she's not going to get, they're not going to say, oh, that's right, I was feeling sad today. It's going to all kind of rest in her.
She even can come to recognize whether cows are contented or not and what fields and what grasses they're grazing.
It's a superpower in its way.
And then her brother, whose name is Joseph, he has another of the problems that come from being in a family. How would you describe him?
I would describe him it's interesting because I think of her, the word porous kind of comes in my mind sometimes in thinking of both of them, that she's sort of, there's something porous in the food that kind of goes into her. And I guess I think of him as the type of character who is possibly even more porous, but the way it has shown up is he kind of shuts everything out. So kind of like the way I think of it, like the guy in Into the Wild, someone who is clearly a very sensitive person but then wants to be about as isolated as possible because something about people is a little bit too much. So that Joseph comes across as kind of maybe brusque or unfriendly, but I imagine that as a kind of armor.
And he is someone who when young was thought to be really bright.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the killer things in families, mm-hmm. let's face it, is the child who was thought to have a gift that turned out to be a normal gift.
Right.
Rather than, you know, the head of the class or the school valedictorian. He was supposed to be, mm-hmm. and his friends were, mm-hmm. very, very bright. Mm-hmm. And as he slid behind, he grew more and more alienated and kind of listless. He doesn't quite know what it is. He still studies hard,
yeah.
but he's basically what looks like, for the longest time in the book, a normal kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Being punished by expectations of abnormality, of giftedness. Mm-hmm. So as if the book is like, at first, a comedy on the subject of giftedness.
Mm-hmm.
Because little Rose, she is gifted, but no one would ever guess, and she can't tell anyone.
Right, right. No, I think that's true. And then his gifts are kind of slipping away by the minute. I mean, he ends up having his own gifts, but they also kind of are not observed really by anyone but her. But yeah, I think it's also kind of a type that interests me, which is a child who shows enormous talent. But then usually most of those children grow into adults who are talented and smart, but not Einstein, you know, not Mozart. So, but that there is a kind of expectation that accrues to that kid that can be damaging.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Amy Bender about her new novel, The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake. Its narrator, Rose, discovers on her 9th birthday that she is able to taste people's emotions in the food they've prepared. And Amy Bender is a writer who I've been reading for years, but I've come too slowly. Her work is magical, but very childlike.
Yeah.
And, you know, it puts accessibility to shame. It's very available work.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
I was reading The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake and saying, oh, now I get it. There's a 9-year-old narrator here. Mm-hmm. All the words are mm-hmm. just perfectly in place.
Mm-hmm.
But then I got to a point where I said, okay, but what's the difference between this and a young adult novel?
Mm-hmm.
So suddenly, mid-book, the most frightening mm-hmm. and mysterious thing happens. Mm-hmm. Joseph mm-hmm. has a gift too.
Mm-hmm.
You're not expecting it at all mm-hmm. because he's even quieter about it.
Yeah.
But he disappears. Did you know that they would both be gifted?
I didn't. I knew that the book kind of began with her and this gift of hers and the idea of food, but I knew that that was not the whole book. So I think it was an entry point and that it was not, it was an entry point into something larger, but I didn't know what. So I think as his behavior started to kind of change and he was mysterious to me as well. And then, kind of her investigation of his gift or where is he going? He seems to be disappearing. That began to kind of take over the book. So I think there's almost a baton passing from what's going on with her to what's going on with him, and that his is, I think, much murkier and a little scarier. Yeah.
Now, in order to talk about and understand this book, we're going to give a little bit away, but I think that there's a deep surprise here
mm-hmm.
that I want to talk about. Because Rose is compassionate, her gift allows her to know feelings. But because Joseph is a turned-off boy,
mm-hmm.
tell what he is.
Well, the surprise or the scene, there's a scene where he's been disappearing, and she goes to his apartment, and basically she discovers that she doesn't even really understand it until the very end of the book. So there's a kind of couple levels of her grasping of it, but that he is able to turn into furniture, essentially become a chair.
He's so alienated that he objectifies himself.
Yeah.
literally.
Literally, exactly.
And not only in a normal, magically realized book, he would become a fancy Ottoman, but his sadness is so great, he becomes a metal folding chair, like every other metal folding chair, so much so that she has to put a squiggle of ink on the folding chair that he is, so that if he manages to make it back,
she'll know.
She'll know which folding chair is him.
Yeah, or even as a type of gravestone, in the same way that I think of how people go to cemeteries to sit at the grave of someone they love, so that she has some way to mourn him by having, you know, feeling like this is him, even though he's gone. But yeah, the fact that he picks a folding chair as opposed to some beautiful object, I think, is very telling.
Yeah.
And also that the mother is all into carpentry, so there's something of a, I think, a rebellious act in picking something that it...
Metallic and machine-made.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's when I started really understanding that it's not exactly magic realism, in that this technique is being used not to raise things to a power of mystery and magic, but rather to explain the ordinary, which seems to me to be your goal as a writer in the other books, the ones it took me longer to come to understand.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right, that the way I'll think about magic or any kind of skew, any kind of dreamlike description or strange happening, is to try to shed light on something mundane, ordinary, but also emotional. So it feels like it's my best access point. So it's not like I'll do it as an alternative to a more realistic telling. It feels like it's the way I know how to talk about feelings, really. So that sadness that you're talking about with the choice of the folding chair is not something that I could have articulated to myself except in the object of the folding chair.
Yeah, so tell me, because this book seems to understand the kids so deeply. Did you grow up with a lot of children? Have you raised children? what's the mystery?
I mean, I grew up with two sisters who were, I mean, not like the characters in the book. But in terms of being around children, I used to teach elementary school, so I definitely have had a lot of contact with kids. I haven't raised them at this point, but I really like children, and I guess I like there's something about the tension between a kind of plain language and a plain diction with complexities that I haven't figured out yet. And there's something about the two together, sort of a very plain brown bag wrapping around a space that I'm trying to figure out the shape of, that this just seems to be the way that I wrangle with the work.
I'm talking to Amy Bender, who has written a novel, The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake. It's published by Doubleday. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Amy Bender about The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake, a heartbreaking and funny novel about how difficult it is to fully love people when you come to know them so well. Now, I wanted to move on to explore development as a writer, because, you know, when I liked The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake so much, I went back and read two of your earlier books, one a book of short stories called Willful Creatures. And I found there two stories that seemed to predict about this new book. One is a story called Leading Man, where we first meet the oblivious father and the crafts mother. And the other is a final story called Him, in which the birth of a whole town of children with special gifts is predicted. Now, do these things, these inner and magical insights, develop gradually?
You know, it's funny when they show up again. It's almost bizarre. For example, my own mother is not someone who likes to do crafts, but I do seem to write a lot about mothers that quilt or are carpenters. There's something being circled around, and sometimes I'll go back and look at previous work and see similar themes or similar images come up. So it does feel like a repeating dream, or a dream that sort of you get more access to each time. And for some reason, the relationship in Woody Allen's movies, Crimes and Misdemeanors and Match Point, comes to mind, where there's something about the recircling around an idea that it was so interesting to just watch both of those and see, okay, he's thinking about his own Crime and Punishment, you know, how these work in those films. So I'm not aware, I think, in launching into the novel that there's references, but then I can see them later. I do know that it makes sense that part of what's tricky about novel writing for me is finding the juice that can go the length of the book. And it makes sense that there's something in the story that's a kernel that then I want to explore more, kind of sprouts.
But I have the feeling that you're interested in mythology and fairy stories and in the way that those deepen. You know, they don't just start. When you read the next fairy tale, it may seem exactly like the one before it, but the themes and the depths they go to are so new, and that's what's exciting here.
Yeah. No, I'm very interested in fairy tales, and I teach a class even on them. And it's really, there's something about rereading them that's so powerful, because the shape of them is so complete. And I feel like they don't really make it to the anthology until they've gone through generations and generations of storytelling. So there's something about reading a tale and then reading a very similar tale, but that has a slightly different turn, and the pleasure in that, the pleasure of the economy and the pleasure of the retelling. And then certain, like there's a grim fairy tale, The Juniper Tree, where it's just a kind of outlandishly dark story where the kid gets cooked in a stew after being killed by the stepmom and then eaten by the father. I mean, it's just this crazy Freudian mix. And so to see that and then see a kind of milder version. So I guess all of those retellings interest me. And I do seem to have an appetite for the reading of fairy tales over and over. I don't get tired of them.
Now, Amy, what's your take on fairy tales? The psychoanalyst Bruno Bettelheim feels that hearing a fairy tale helps a child adapt. What do you think?
I mean, I love his idea. There's something so hopeful in his idea that the child is kind of learning through the repeated telling of a fairy tale something about growing up, and the child actually needs the fairy tales. I do actually feel like, since they show up kind of similarly all over in every culture, there's something necessary about fairy tales. There's something kind of DNA structurally appealing to the human mind about hearing a short story, often with three quests or something in it, and often with, you know, a bad sibling and a good sibling and a bad parent and a good parent. All of that feels like it has this deep resonance. So I subscribe to his belief. I think what I love about them is theories just attached to fairy tales, like darts or something, that you can... they work so well from psychological theoretical perspectives and from feminist points of view, and then you can do a Marxist read, and you know, they kind of attract and repel theories. And I think there's an essay by Donald Barthelme in Not Knowing where he talks about wonderful art will do that. It will both invite the breaking down of the art and it will repel it at the same time. I think he talks about Rauschenberg's goat sculpture, and he says, you know, you kind of understand it and then you don't. You think you got it and then you can't have it anymore. And that there's something about fairy tales where they both, They never are done. They're never completed.
You know, I read this as a version of the writer's gift. You know, that the writer is the one condemned to seeing more and figuring out how to use the gift.
I think it can be. I mean, it makes sense that I think that is part of writing, is trying to articulate something of what has been seen. Or Deborah Eisenberg had a beautiful statement about the writer kind of looking for the subterranean truths that are going on and maybe arriving at them a little bit before cultural knowledge of them. That would be the ideal writing display, I think, is to say something a little bit before it even occurs. And that would come from that same kind of underground sensitivity. But and I think she really does that beautifully. But what I guess it feels like it can apply to many different things, because there's so many levels of ways to have insight. So it can be the writer, it can be the artist, it can be the thinker, it can be the philosopher, it can be the psychologist, it can be, you know, any number of people who are wondering about knowing oneself and knowing other people.
Yeah. Debbie Eisenberg just won a Genius Award.
I saw that.
She's a short story writer who we deeply, deeply love. You've heard her on Bookworm before. Now, I'm curious, do you think of the book as a fairy tale?
This one?
Yeah.
I don't actually. I mean, it's maybe subtle, but I think of a book like Willful Creatures as being more directly fairy tale influenced than this particular Sadness of Lemon Cake, which there's felt to me like there was some subtle shift. I think because there's something a little bit frightening. I mean, not like fairy tales aren't frightening, because they are, but they're almost comically frightening. And there was something in the book for me that felt a little genuinely frightening to write about in certain ways. I think the stuff about Joseph, the brother. So that felt less of a fairy tale influence directly.
One of the things that really pleased me, actually, was when I looked at the copyright page. Books always tell you how the Library of Congress thinks of the book. And it says, one, taste, fiction. Two, family secrets, fiction. And three, psychological fiction. And I thought, yeah, it really is psychological fiction, even though most of the time we think of surrealism and magic realism as being the movement away from psychology.
It does feel to me that thinking psychologically really fuels how I want to think about characters, but I don't want to talk about their psychology in any, in any way of sort of just unpacking, well, they have this growing up and this relates to this problem later on. And I really strongly believe that psychologically there's never really a one-to-one relationship between what happens to someone as a kid and who they become as an adult. So it's a much messier world. So I think there's something about illustrating that messiness that I can access more easily through the metaphor. But it's interesting too, because I think of surrealism or the movement of surrealism as not being psychological but being sort of parallel. I guess that's how I would think of it, as kind of an excitement about Freud and dreams, but a way of kind of approaching that world without explaining, without wanting to unpack, well, this is what the dream is about, but a real celebration of that as a resource, which I think is still psychological. It's just not doing the interpretation. So I think there's something to, because when I'm writing, I'm never thinking, oh, I want this metaphor to equal this meaning. I'm just, and I think that's another reason I'm attracted to magical realism of any sort, is that it feels like you get a very tangible thing in the book, which is suddenly there's all this food or there are all these objects. And I can just write about those and try to shut down my sense of what does it mean. Because if I knew what I was talking about as I was writing it, I think it would end up kind of thin. So I guess the hope is that if I can kind of push away my analysis until maybe the end point, then it gives a reader room.
As I was reading this book, I thought, oh, The reason why Amy Bender still lives in the city where she was born and writes about people sort of like people one can imagine her knowing, boys she went out with, girls who were her girlfriends or girls who were worse, her enemies, is that you stay in a place in order to know it better. So that it wasn't so much that feeling of, I want to be a kid forever, you know, the Peter Pan feeling.
Definitely not.
I want to become a wise woman.
Oh, well, that's a very kind switch. Thank you. I think there is something about wanting to know and investigate. And I guess I think what I find is that sometimes the world of childhood and adolescence is so charged and so packed with information about who we become and what our relationships are to other people. And so it feels like really rich territory to me. So I think what I'm always trying to follow is, where is the charge in the language? Where is the stuff that feels a little bit difficult to write about? And then in that, kind of following that through, that seems to be where all the writing is coming from. So sometimes I'll be surprised if the narrators are young or if, you know, I tend to like to write about adolescence. But it is a way of trying to circle around to something, hopefully, that is more complex.
I've been talking with Amy Bender, author most recently of The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake. And what I want to say about the book, I didn't want to say it until we reached the end, is that its effect is, without having explained anything in any obvious way, the book has the effect on this reader of a successfully psychoanalyzed dream.
Well, that's nice to hear. All right. No, that's good to hear.
And because it's the dream that we so frequently don't understand, the dream of how families are the way they are.
Yeah.
That's what made it such a rich and valuable experience for me.
Thank you.
Thank you. You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our new media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.